Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up this hour, our 2020 caucus series, Home State View, continues. Wayne Messam, he's a Democratic presidential candidate. We'll have a home state view of him. He's from Florida. New research on interviewing techniques for Title IX as well. Also, we'll find out about the fire that destroyed Ogden's only grocery store, a historic grocery store, as it turns out. But first, Tuesday, of course, marked an off-year election. On Wednesday's Politics Day, if you tuned in, we discussed the possible implications for the 2020 presidential race with our political analysts. Now a different perspective on Tuesday's election results from Aaron Murphy. He covers Iowa politics and government for The Gazette. Hi, Aaron.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Ben.
Thank you for being with us. I enjoyed reading your article in The Gazette today about the elections. The headline was, Iowa voters still have a purple streak, but this election shows it's a different shade. Explain.
Yeah, the last few elections, and especially in 2018 in Iowa, it was an interesting result in the way that it was a mixed bag for the two major parties. So for the longest time, we had been used to Iowa as being a purple state. In the different elected officials we had. So we had a Republican governor, but the state at the same time voted twice for a Democratic president. We had one, for the longest time, one Republican and one Democratic U.S. senator. For a while there, the congressional delegation was a perfect split, even number of Republicans and Democrats. This more recent election, it was kind of an interesting in the way that there was good and bad for both parties, and it showed Iowa purple in a different way, in that Republicans did well at the state level. In the state, they kept control of the state house. They won the governor's race again. But at the congressional level, Democrats had the good night. They flipped a couple of seats, and now three of the four U.S. House members from Iowa are Democrats. So it was kind of an interesting mixed bag. Part of that was driven by gains made in the suburbs, which I'm sure you talked about earlier this week, and which we've seen elsewhere in the country, including again this week and some of the elections in Kentucky and Virginia. So Iowa's not unique to that, and that's been driving some of the new ways that Iowa looks like a purple state now.
Mm-hmm. Also in your article, it was interesting that under a category called election nuggets, you had some very interesting information that sets Iowa apart in terms of some statistics here, don't they?
And forgive me, you'll have to refresh my memory on those.
Okay, so the election nuggets, we had Iowans cast the most ever votes in a midterm election this time, right?
Yeah, and that speaks to just kind of the energy that we see out there right now, and that has not relaxed in any way. We still see that all the time as reporters when we're covering this caucus cycle right now. There's a lot of energy around this Democratic primary, and still a lot of – I mean, we don't – it's hard to see it manifested because there's not – at least a competitive primary going on the Republican side, but you still get that sense that the Republicans are also engaged right now too. So that turnout was a big number. I would not be surprised to see the 2020 election be another a big number as far as turnout goes in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And part of that too was, and this may have been in that story, was the youth turnout. That was a significant bump. We saw more young voters than we're used to. Typically a very low turnout voting block. There's a little bit more engagement in the young voters these days. Will be interesting to see if that maintains to the next election, to 2020. I know there have been some advocacy groups that have working on that, voting block specifically. I'm sure that played into that. I have no doubt of that, that helped drive up that number. So, yeah, engagement is high. Interest is high across the electorate, but especially among young voters.
Okay, thank you very much. Aaron Murphy covers Iowa politics and government for the Gazette. We'll check in again in the future. Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks, as always, for having me, Ben.
NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Title IX, I'm sure you've heard of it. Perhaps you know quite a bit about it. But if you don't, it dates back to the early 1970s. It's a federal civil rights law that declares, and I'm reading verbatim, no person in the U.S. shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. Now, when violations of Title IX are claimed, there is an investigation. But new research at Iowa State University finds the techniques investigators are using may not be the most effective. Findings were published in the Journal of Applied Research in Memory and Cognition. Joining us, one of the authors of that article, Adrian Lyles, is Associate Director of Equal Opportunity, Senior Deputy Title IX Coordinator, and Associate Teaching Professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at ISU. Adrian Lyles, welcome to our program.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So explain a little bit more what you looked at in this study.
Sure. So the idea is that if there is an investigation in a Title IX matter, so there's an allegation of discrimination on the basis of sex or gender, and especially when we're talking about sexual misconduct, so sexual harassment or sexual assault, an investigation has to be impartial, has to be equitable, and it has to be fair. So Dr. Meissner and I were very interested in looking at over 30 years of research to see what investigative techniques are most effective at eliciting information and facilitating recall from witnesses to an investigation.
Mm-hmm. And you found out that, well, these may not be the best practices. The current practices may not be entirely the best practices. Give us a couple highlights.
Sure. So we know it doesn't work. So investigative techniques that are confrontational, that are accusatorial or judgmental, those don't work. Investigators sometimes will use leading questions or presumptive questions, closed questions that promote a yes or no answer, or questioning techniques that overemphasize nonverbal cues. We find that those do not work in terms of they don't facilitate recall, they don't facilitate accurate memories, they can be manipulative. So we were looking to see what investigative techniques does the science show us work.
Mm-hmm. So give us an example. Most of us have not been involved in a Title IX investigation,
sure.
But set a scene and tell us what we're talking about here.
Sure. So we use the language of complainants, respondents, and witnesses. So there's an allegation that somebody did something wrong to somebody else, and there are often witnesses to that potential wrongdoing. So when an interview is just, like a Title IX investigator, a coordinator, speaking with a witness, just asking questions to try to get them to accurately recall what happened. We're neutral fact finders. We just want to know what happened. So we want to ask questions that promote their dignity, make them feel safe, make them feel welcomed, and help them accurately retrieve their memories so that we can do our jobs and again, figure out what happened.
Mm-hmm. So go back to the point you made, I think, that watching the behavior of the respondent during the interview, not a good practice.
No, because people can, for instance, seem nervous, right? Their skin can flush. They could have trouble recalling. They might close their eyes. That could be due to a lot of reasons. So you don't want to judge someone based on those nonverbal cues. Rather, you want to give people an opportunity to share their story, to tell us what happened, to recall details of events to the best of their ability.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if when you looked at this, if your research covered whether, given current practices, have there been investigations led to false conclusions, do you think? And Christian Meissner, your co-author, think.
So what's interesting is there just hasn't been a study of investigations as they relate to the Title IX context. So lots of reviews of literature in more interrogation techniques, law enforcement interviewing, this is very particular to the educational context, right? So Title IX is about education. So we find that if we can limit our bias, if we can develop rapport, facilitate cooperation, enhance retrieval, and really understand that this is, these investigations are designed to make sure that folks are able to fully engage in their education, right? Or their employment. So it's a totally new study. Those of us who do the work in Title IX, there isn't best practice for interviewing techniques in the Title IX context. So Dr. Meissner and I are beginning to try to figure out what techniques work best in this particular educational context.
Mm-hmm. Have you found interesting reaction to this research yet?
Sure. I had suspected that people who do this work were very hungry for information. We receive trainings from law firms, from associations, but there's no established science-backed practice for the work. I have received an overwhelming response from Title IX practitioners across the country who are asking me to share more about our practice and procedures here at Iowa State because we believe that we do it well and do it right. So the response has been overwhelmingly supportive and encouraging that this work continue to develop.
Mm-hmm. Does your research open the door to other questions you'd like to investigate here?
Sure. Our findings are very preliminary, so we kind of came up with four main particular investigative techniques that are working well in the Title IX context. We would like to develop those findings, discover what other techniques work, and continue to engage in really figuring out what works best overall in Title IX investigations.
Mm-hmm. And how many Title IX investigations are there around the country?
Roughly. Sure. I cannot give you a rough number. Mm-hmm. And here at Iowa State, we do track those numbers. Those are available on our Equal Opportunity website. But different institutions have different practices for how they collect that information. So it's very difficult to establish how many Title IX investigations different K-12 or higher ed institutions are conducting.
Okay, thank you very much. Fascinating research by Adrian Lyles, also another fellow researcher at ISU, Christian Meissner. Adrian, thank you for coming into the studio and joining us.
Thanks so much for your time.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end this news week. Well, a fire has destroyed the only grocery store in the central Iowa community of Ogden. No injuries, thankfully. And we'll hear more from Miranda Parker of the Ogden Reporter in just a moment about the fire. And there's an investigation into what caused it. But first, Charity Nebbe has popped into the studio to tell us about her family's connection with the grocery store. Charity, hi.
Hello, Ben.
What is the connection?
So back in 1899, my great-grandfather, Detlef Nebbe, who was a recent immigrant from Germany at the time, built that grocery store in Ogden, Iowa. And he passed away in 1928, but his wife continued to run the store. Frances Nebbe continued to run the store through the early 1960s. It was sold. She passed away in 64, and it was sold in 66.
Uh-huh. So you don't have any memory of this, or do you? Have you been to the grocery store?
I have been to the grocery store.
But not when it was in the Nebbe family.
No, not when it was in the family. Although my dad has many stories about working in the store when he was growing up and never getting paid.
Fascinating. Tell us, what was your reaction, your family's reaction, when you heard the news, the sad news of this fire?
Well, I think the overwhelming reaction was that we're just all really sad for Ogden because it's a town that, you know, of course, we've had a very long connection with. My great-grandparents were there. My dad grew up there. My uncle still lives there. But when I was growing up, I lived there until I was five. There were two grocery stores in Ogden. The farm crisis hit and the downtown really emptied out. So we've seen people work really hard to keep locally owned businesses going in Ogden. And this is just a really big blow.
Yeah. Oh, well, we share your sadness. Charity Nebbe, thanks for stopping in.
Thank you, Ben.
Joining me now from our Ames studio, Miranda Parker, marketing consultant and office manager for the Ogden Reporter. Miranda, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. You heard Charity talk about her family connections. We're very, very sorry for the burning down of the Ogden Mart grocery store after a fire on Saturday night. Tell us your personal view. How did you become aware of the fire? What was it like?
Well, I was sitting at home Saturday night, and somebody had messaged me and said, "Hey, the grocery store's on fire," and I was like, uh-oh, you know, how bad is it? And I didn't hear back right away, so I hopped in my car and drove to Ogden. And as I was coming out of Boone, I could see the entire, like, sky lit up from the fire. So I was like, oh, boy. And then I parked my car and just walked up to it, and I was just in complete amazement and shock.
I imagine there was there were a number of people in Ogden watching this spectacle.
Yes, there were a number of people watching it, but then on top of that, there were like, I want to say like 6 to 8 different fire departments that were there.
Mm-hmm. And it was it known early that no one was injured or worse?
Yes, it was known early that nobody was injured or anything like that. They had just closed the store at 8 o'clock, and it was called in, I want to say, within like a half hour of the store closing.
Mm-hmm. So you've spoken with the people of Ogden. What did they say about this great loss for the community? It was the only grocery store in Ogden, and you have to go quite a ways to get to another grocery store, right?
Yep. Boone is the closest, and that's about 10 miles. So it's kind of, it really is a big loss for the community because, last year in the transition between owners, we didn't have a grocery store for several months, and that really impacted the community in the way of, the older residents, and they can't make, you know, they might not be able to make it to Boone. So not having something where you can just walk down the street or walk down the block, or some of the services, you know, where people would deliver the groceries for them, it's going to be definitely a change to try to figure something out.
Mm-hmm. I saw pictures of in the Ogden Reporter's website of the heavy equipment moving away the remains of the grocery store. It's early days yet. Any talk, do you know, of rebuilding a store?
The current business owner said that if the city were able to help him rebuild, that it's something that he would love to continue to have a business in Ogden. But I think it's going about being able to completely rebuild a business like that.
Yep. Okay. Miranda Parker, we're very sorry for Ogden community's loss there of the Ogden Mart grocery store. Thank you for your account of that.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Let's turn to Dave Swenson, associate scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University. We love to turn to Dave to put things in context. Dave, welcome to the program.
No, thank you.
We want to sort of expand this, enlarge this conversation in the 5 minutes that we have. Your thoughts on this fire and how it fits into the larger trend of rural communities losing their grocers.
Well, we have had lots of small towns struggle to maintain or have lose their grocers. The threshold of people required to maintain a grocery store really depends on the community. You have the degree to which people come into the community or go out of the community, the degree to which the community is a regional trade center. Ogden is a community where 3/4 of the people that live in Ogden work outside of town. So the flow on a daily basis is outside of town, usually to a trade center like Boone or Ames or some other place. And so a lot of what would be your casual daytime retail activities and service activities is going on elsewhere. And so towns like Ogden, which are significantly externally dependent, struggle to maintain their retail vibrancy. And this is a community that it's very, very evident that retail, what we call retail leakages, are really, really strong. They only are basically serving on a statistical basis. We have a measure of it. And they're serving about 650 of their 2,000 residents on a statistical basis. So they're really leaking a lot of sales. Recovering sales, like a grocery store or anything that you can do to entice people to shop locally, it creates a multiplier effect locally, but it also simply enriches the opportunities and the fabric of commercial activity in a small town.
Right, and Miranda said, well, maybe there are thoughts of rebuilding a grocery store there in Ogden, but in the meantime, for months or however long it takes to build, people will will necessarily have new shopping habits, and then to pull them away from those newly gained habits back to a more local purchase, right, would be a problem.
Yeah, it would. And remember, though, that they already, the community already has substantial leakages. Their patterns of shopping are significantly external. Again, you have metros nearby, you have Boone nearby. Those pulls are really, really powerful. And the existence of those large retail centers nearby really undermine the capacity of some of these smaller towns in developing and redeveloping their retail activity. Now, we had seen a slight uptick in their retail activity in recent years, so there was a little bit of stability that seemed to be injecting itself into that community prior to this happening. And now, of course, you're going to lose those sales, and you're going to lose those sales opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the impact of the growing online retail on all of our communities.
That's true. And by the way, that is one of the alternatives that perhaps some people will turn to or have to turn to because of mobility limitations. They're going to seek retail opportunities using Amazon or perhaps Walmart or other types of services.
Right. So instead of going down the road 10 miles for your groceries, you go out in your driveway and you'll see a drone land with your whatever you need. Are you looking forward to those times, Dave?
I'm not. Although I shop significantly online, I don't know that I'm ready for drones.
Okay, I gave a little snapshot of my kind of weird picture of the future. What do you see in the future in the terms of shopping for groceries in more rural parts of the state?
Yeah, it's going to continue to get to be difficult for retailers of all kinds to maintain their vibrancy in many of these small towns. Two-thirds of Iowa's communities are still contracting. Two-thirds of Iowa's counties are contracting. And without shoppers, we're going to lose stores. And so it is one of those things. It's a reality that we're having to live with. Small towns are trying to create cooperatives or other types of structures to maintain their shopping, not just for grocery stores, but grocery stores stand out the most. And some succeed, but most do not.
Mm-hmm. Any advice in the few seconds we have for those listening in smaller communities?
Okay, well, the first thing you do is to the degree that you're capable, shop locally, because if you're not shopping locally, you're basically bleeding your local retail to death.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much, Dave Swenson, for weighing in on this. Associate scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University. Thanks for coming into our studio, Dave.
My pleasure.
Coming up in our second half of News Buzz, a home state view of presidential candidate Wayne Messam, and then our News Buzz series is introduced called Winter Coach.
It's cold outside. You don't know cold.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty ominous. If you knew a person from warmer climes was headed into their very first Iowa winter as an adult, what advice would you give them? You'll have a chance in our second half hour, your chance to be a winter coach. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of News Buzz here on River to River after a short break.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast, Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Time now for another conversation in our Home State View series. In the run-up to the 2020 caucuses, we're getting a different perspective on the presidential candidates by talking with people who've been covering them in their home states. Today, a home state view of Democratic candidate Wayne Messam, Mayor Messam of Miramar, Florida. Joining us with a home state view, Katie Switalski is WLRN Broward County reporter. She's joining us. Miramar is in Broward County. Katie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Well, let's start off with Wayne Messam, of course, not the best known of the candidates, perhaps even the least known of the candidates. Let's talk a little bit about his rise to the office of mayor there in Florida.
So Wayne Messam is actually a former football player who started a business with his wife in construction and general contracting. And he ran for city commissioner in 2011 and won. And his race for mayor, he won in 2015 and became the mayor of Miramar. He got almost 39% of the vote, and he beat out the vice mayor and an incumbent at the time. And he's been mayor ever since.
Mm-hmm. What appealed to the people of Miramar about his leadership and about his campaign?
He's pretty outspoken, and he really does have a lot of charisma, very charismatic. He is very genuine when he's having a conversation with you. And he normally does not shy away from some controversial topics. So he's been trying to protect the Everglades right bordering near Miramar from exploratory oil drilling. He's been trying to sue the state of Florida with other mayors in South Florida for the right to be able to create some local gun control measures. And so about the issues he cares about, he is very outspoken.
Mm-hmm. We're asking in this series, Katie, about the team that he surrounds himself with, the people he seeks out for support. What can you tell us about them?
The people that he's seeking, he's not looking for super PAC money. And he said from the beginning of his campaign launch in late March, he announced his candidacy at a historically Black college and university, Florida Memorial University. And so he very much wants to connect with young people, students, small donors, the $5, $10, $20 donors to build his campaign for the presidency.
What does he count as his successes in his time as mayor there in Miramar, Florida?
One of the things he really thinks of as a success is his small business being, you know, as he considers himself, a job creator in his own community. And Miramar also passed a living wage ordinance in 2015. And the issues like gun control and the environment, protecting the Everglades that he stood up for, he sees these issues on a small scale in Miramar. I mean, the city's only about 141,000 people, less than 150,000 people. And he sees these issues as having huge national significance. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about his leadership is he really considers this election of the mayor, the year of the mayor. And I think nationally, we see that a lot with Mayor Pete Buttigieg from South Bend, Indiana. But Wayne Messam sort of is comparing Miramar to South Bend, Indiana, and argues that it's a lot more diverse, it's larger, and the issues he's had to deal with are more applicable to the presidency than, say, maybe Mayor Pete Buttigieg has had to come up against so far.
Mm-hmm. In his time as mayor, what criticisms? Talk a little bit more about the criticisms that Wayne Messam has faced.
So he's been very outspoken about immigration, and he is very pro finding paths to citizenship. But one of the criticisms he's faced is there is an immigration and customs enforcement facility located in Miramar, an ICE facility, where people come for their regular immigration appointments. And there are weekly protests at this facility. And he's really been criticized for having been so outspoken and seeming to care so much about immigration rights, but then not coming to protests when he says he's going to show up, or not doing more to sort of work with the federal government and reduce the problems that the ICE facility in Miramar has run into.
Mm-hmm. And how does he react to that and other criticism?
You know, Mayor Messam, I think, tries to put on a front and work out his criticisms on the back end before bringing it to the media. One of his biggest, I think, issues in this election is he really thinks the media distribution among candidates has been unfair. But it's hard sometimes to cover him when his campaign is not necessarily responsive to inquiries or criticism. And I think that's something he faces. I think he's been continually saying he's going to go to the ICE facility. And then when I talk with protesters, he maybe doesn't, you know, they haven't seen him come by yet. So I think it's something that he says he's going to work on, but maybe some of the voters haven't seen that come to fruition yet.
Katie, I'm sure you're well aware of what happens when you do an online news search about Mayor Wayne Messam. I found, at least, most of the articles are with the headline that he raised $5 in the last quarter of fundraising as a presidential candidate. He's never come close to qualifying for a Democratic debate. He has next to no name recognition. This is 90 days before the Iowa caucuses, a year out from the general election. we have to ask, and what is your answer to the question, why is he still in the race? No traction at all, it seems.
It does seem that way, and it's true. And the $5 campaign finance report came out just a few weeks ago. And he told the New York Times that it was some sort of computer glitch. Now, he'd overreported in the first quarter what he had brought in terms of donations. So it seems there's a lot of criticism there. And there's other criticism that he has not been cutting paychecks for his campaign staff. So there are definitely some back-end problems. But I think his response to this is, you know, whether it's a computer glitch or not, we don't know weeks later. So there's really less of a response right now. Now, in terms of early on in the race when he was asked, hey, you really don't have name recognition compared to some of the other candidates like Joe Biden. Why are you running in the first place? He's really maintained that these issues that he's had to deal with as a mayor are closer to the people than someone at a state level or closer to the people with national significance, such as, you know, the ICE facility in Miramar or the pushing for gun control after the Parkland shooting here. And he's really arguing that his vote and what his community has done while he's mayor matters more than his name recognition. And that seems to be his continued stance. But I will admit he's been very quiet. And in my reaching out to his campaign over the last week, I still haven't heard back on, you know, what's the latest update with them.
Okay, our Home State View series, in these conversations, Katie, we like to end on a lighter note, perhaps a note of sort of a, that indicates the personality of our candidates, in this case, Mayor Wayne Messam. Go into a little bit more about a professional football player.
He was, and he's pretty outspoken about being a football player, but he played for Florida State University in Tallahassee, our state capital. But he was actually really good. He was a starting wide receiver, and the fun fact is he was a member of the 1993 national championship team for FSU. So if you're a Noles fan anywhere, Messam played a big part in that.
Katie Switalski, thank you very much. WLRN Broward County reporter with our Home State View of Mayor Wayne Messam, a presidential candidate in the Democratic column. Thank you very much, Katie.
Thank you for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
You're a long way from home. Winter is coming.
Winter is coming, indeed. The sudden drop in temperatures, our early snows here in the Midwest, have reminded us more than any ominous Game of Thrones character could. Which brings us to a conversation I had a couple of weeks ago with our newest talk show producer here at Iowa Public Radio.
Well, it's late October, a sunny afternoon, late October. Temperatures in the mid-40s, I think we're up to right here. I'm walking on the sidewalk in Iowa City. Comes some construction you hear in the background with IPR producer, talk show producer Matt Alvarez. Hi, Matt.
How's it going?
It's going well. You've trusted me because I haven't really told you what this is about at all, have I?
No, I have no idea what's going on.
Well, here's what I want to ask you about. You are facing your first Iowa winter, right?
That is correct.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. You're from where?
Well, I grew up in El Paso. I lived 22 years there of my life, and then I moved to Austin right after that, and spent 10 years there until I interviewed and got the job over here in Iowa.
Okay, so how old are you now?
I am 32.
You're 32, so your life up to this point has been spent in Texas.
My entire life.
Okay, so how much winter have you experienced?
Well, El Paso, I typically saw a white Christmas every other year, but it never really got too cold, and snow never really stuck around for too long, as in it would snow, and then it would be gone by the mid-afternoon.
So when you say white Christmas, you say how deep would your snow be in El Paso?
Anywhere from 3 inches, and if we were lucky, 8.
Really? This is El Paso?
Yeah. And in the summer, it would get up into the hundreds, 110s.
Okay, so I guess you're giving me a different vision of El Paso, but all right, I never suspected El Paso could ever have 3 to 8 inches of snow.
Yeah, and what, like I said, it would only happen once or twice a year, as in like once in December and maybe in January.
What are your thoughts about, based on what you've heard of a Midwest winter and Iowa winter, what are your thoughts as we start to trend down in our temperatures?
I've heard nothing but things that would scare me. I know every jacket that I own up until this point is probably not warm enough for maybe January or February. And I don't have any shoes that I think would allow me to walk on ice, which I think is what I'm most fearful of.
Ice. You've heard ice stories. What kind of ice stories?
Just freezing rain. Catherine told me that she once hit a patch of ice and slid into another car in a parking lot. And I'm
like, yep. Ditto here. My first car accident was actually at the age of 16. I just got my driver's license. I went out to go on a date, first solo date. I drove my parents' car and, get this, wait for it, slid into a parked police car.
Oh, man.
So it's good to know about your background here. You have some snow background, but largely you have not gone through an entire winter, which lasts for months.
No.
Ever?
Ever.
Okay. And you've got some trepidation.
Yeah. I think I've just never experienced a severe drop in cold temperature.
Just sustained severe.
Yeah. One year, I guess, when the polar vortex dipped low enough while I was in college, it was about 17 degrees. But like I said, that only lasted a day.
17 degrees.
And it's 17 degrees. People in Texas just don't have it. They shut down the schools. Everyone just stays at home and just waits for it to warm back up again.
I'm going to give you a Midwest chuckle.
If I can tell you this, every person that I spoke to, like my landlord, even people that I've been interviewing and I introduce myself that I'm new to Iowa, they say, "Oh my God, you're about to experience winter," and they just laugh.
Like I just did.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, we do take a little bit of glee in this. I don't know if that's so healthy.
Well, I mean, I think I would laugh if we had to endure weeks upon weeks of 100 degree temperatures.
Right. Okay. You would turn the tables on me there.
Absolutely.
Okay. So we're walking outside and we're by the bike rack here at Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. And you're a bike commuter to work.
I am, yes.
And next to your bike is my bike. I happen to be a bike commuter, and I bike to work every day, also through the worst weather. I am known for it, I have to say. November, December, January, February are not off limits to me.
I think I want to go as long as I can.
Okay. More than biking, I want to make a proposal to you, Matt Alvarez. May I do that?
Sure.
Being as it's your first Midwest winter, you've heard of a life coach, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be your life coach. You don't need a life coach.
Okay.
I want to be your winter coach.
Okay. I think I need one of those.
So, yeah? Are you down with that?
I'm all for it.
Are you? Okay. So what we'll do is, here's the plan. See if you're okay with this. Over the next few weeks and months, we'll check in with you regularly. Find out how you're doing in this Iowa winter 2019 to 2020. Maybe I have some tips for you. Maybe we can help you through this winter. How about that?
I would appreciate that. And it actually sounds like a ton of fun. I think people will enjoy my misery throughout the next 3 months. Wait, how long does winter last?
That depends.
Yeah.
It can last, let's say March, but maybe through April.
Okay. Well, it sounds like I'll need the coaching.
Matt, thanks for being a good sport, and we'll check in with you later.
All right, thanks, Ben.
A conversation I had with IPR producer Matt Alvarez a couple of weeks ago. Matt joins me in the studio now, November 8th. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Ben. Great to be here.
We've dropped temperatures. We've had even a couple snowfalls here in Iowa. You biked in, right?
I did bike in. I've been biking in for a couple weeks now.
Mm-hmm. And this is probably one of the coldest days.
This was actually one of the coldest days that I've experienced so far on my bike. I checked the temperature right when I got in. It was about 21 degrees, and the wind chill was 14. I could feel it on my face. I could feel it on my hands. It was pretty,
pretty awful. Okay. I'm not going to lie, it did not feel good.
Okay, so what have been your observations the last couple of weeks? You had to get around in snow on occasion.
Yeah, the snow caught me off guard.
The Halloween snow.
I was actually pretty scared when I got on my bike. I was like, I hope I can make it in here. I hope I can do this. Because there was a lot of snow. A lot of it wasn't cleared. I think the city was kind of caught off guard at that moment. But I did manage to take the main roads, and I did carefully ride my bike there, and I didn't hit any patches of ice just yet.
Okay, you and I are both bike commuters. Have no fear. We're going to get through winter as much as we can on our bikes commuting to work. Mm-hmm. I have plenty of tips for you in a future edition of Winter Coach. Finally, you talked about the sensation on your bike, your cold hands.
Yeah,
cold,
I've never experienced this before, so I don't have a lot of words in my vocabulary to describe what the cold on my skin would feel like.
I have something just for you. Because you've accepted my offer of being your winter coach, I have a little gift for you.
Oh, man.
Matt Alvarez. Look at that.
To Matt from your winter coach. And this is like a scarf that you put over your face and mouth.
There's a name for it. It's a balaclava.
Okay.
A balaclava, not a baklava. Mm-hmm. Baklava. I think I got it mixed up once. I mentioned to someone that it was cold, so I was going to start wearing my baklava.
Okay.
And they said, you're going to start wearing your Turkish dessert? This is a balaclava. It is, you know, a hood that goes over your mm-hmm. neck. Your neck is covered. Most of your face is covered. That will keep your skin from freezing.
Great. Well, Ben, I really appreciate this. Thank you.
Matt Alvarez will be checking back in with you. We want to invite our listeners to help Matt through the winter. Over the next few months, we're going to be checking in with Matt to see how he's doing. What are your practical tips, your observations, your coping strategies for getting through winter? Perhaps you have a winter poem you'd like to share with Matt and the rest of us. Email your contribution to rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org with the subject line, Winter Coach. I hope you feel you're in good hands, Matt.
I do, but I'm going to need all the help that I can get, so
okay.
Please send those emails.
And to finish up this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, let's go to Mark Simmet, IPR One, RPR Studio One host. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Ben.
We've got I see on my paper. You've got perhaps my all-time favorite artist here. He's got something
really?
New out, right? Yeah, Van Morrison?
Yes. Did not know that Van Morrison was your all-time favorite artist, so that's great. Yes, he has a brand new one, and it's called, it's hard to believe no one has used this as an album title before, Three Chords and the Truth.
Let's listen.
Take the TV. No policeman at large. There's nobody in charge. Politicians that waffle endlessly, and people just don't want to see. Get them fed too much for screwing up. Don't you think everyone's had enough? There's nobody in charge, at least that we know.
Van Morrison, Nobody in Charge, from his new album, Three Chords and the Truth. I just Googled his age, 74 years old, cranking out such good music at 73. I hope I can do anything like
his
that.
His voice is still
amazing.
In great shape.
Take us out with another tune.
All right. Well, it's hard to follow Van Morrison, but this is a band that has also been around for a long time, formed in Berkeley, California in 1970. And they're back with a new album. They are the Rubinews, and continuing to make music after almost 50 years. They have a new record out called From Home, and this is Do You Remember?
Okay. Mark Simmet, thanks for grooving us into the weekend. IPR Studio One host, Mark. Thanks so much.
All right. Stay warm on that bike, Ben.
I will.
California. Thank you.
Down in the basement, hugging along.
The Roomba News, Do You Remember, from the new album titled From Home. Do check out our IPR Studio One offerings. River to River is available as a podcast. Just a reminder, subscribe to River using your favorite podcast app or go to iowapublicradio.org. You can also download our IPR app. It's a good way not to miss River to River, also to share programming with others. River to River is produced by Texas native and new Iowa transplant, Matt Alvarez. Caitlin Harrop and Rick Brewer also helped today from Julia DiGiacomo. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. We'll have special programming Monday, Veterans Day, to honor our veterans. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend and honor our veterans.